There was a crash from the scullery. "So it's a good job the money don't matter," Granny Weatherwax went on. "It'd be a terrible thing otherwise, all that money. Mattering." Nanny Ogg's white face appeared round the edge of the door.
"He never."
"Could be a bit more," said Granny.
"It never."
"You just adds up and divides and that." Nanny Ogg stared in horrified fascination at her own fingers.
"But that's a..."
She stopped. The only word she could think of was fortune, and that wasn't adequate. Witches didn't operate in a cash economy. The whole of the Ramtops, by and large, got by without the complications of capital. $50 was a fortune. $100 was a... Well, it was two fortunes. That was what it was.
"It's a lot of money," she said weakly. "What couldn't I do with money like that?"
"Dunno," said Granny Weatherwax. "What did you do with the $3?
"Got it in a tin up the chimney," said Nanny Ogg.
Granny nodded approvingly. This was the kind of good fiscal practice she liked to see. "Beats me why people would fall over themselves to read a cookery book, though," she added. "I mean, it's not the sort of thing..." The room fell silent. Nanny Ogg shuffled her boots. Granny said, in a voice laden with a suspicion that was all the worse because it wasn't quite yet sure what it was suspicious of, "It is a cookery book, isn't it?"
"Oh, yes," said Nanny hurriedly, avoiding Granny's gaze. "Yes. Recipes in that, yes."
Granny glared at her.
"Just recipes?"
"Yes. Oh, yes.
Yes. And, some cookery anecdotes, yes."
Granny went on glaring. Nanny gave in.
"Look under famous carrot and oyster pie," she said. "Page 25.
Granny turned the pages. Her lips moved silently. Then,
"I see. Anything else?"
"Cinnamon and marshmallow fingers, page 17.
Granny looked it up.
"And?
Celery astonishment, page 10.
Granny looked that up too.
"Can't say it astonished me," she said. "And?
Well, more or less, all of humorous puddings and cake decoration. That's all of chapter 6. I've done illustrations for that."
Granny turned to chapter 6. She had to turn the book around a couple of times.
"What one are you looking at?" said Nanny Ogg, because an author is always keen to get feedback.
"Strawberry Wobbler," said Granny.
"Oh, that one always gets a laugh."
It did not appear to be obtaining one from Granny. She carefully closed the book.
"Giffin," she said, "this is me asking you this. Is there any page in this book, is there any single recipe, which does not in some way relate to goings-on?"
Nanny Ogg, her face red as apples, seemed to give this some lengthy consideration. "Porridge," she said eventually.
"Really?"
"Yes. No. I tell a lie, it's got my special honey mixture in it."
Granny turned a page.
"What about this one, Maids of Honour?"
"Well, they starts out as Maids of Honour," said Nanny, fidgeting with her feet, "but they ends up tarts."
Granny looked at the front cover again.
"The Joy of Snacks. And you actually set out..." "Well, it's just sort of turned out that way, really."
Granny Weatherwax was not a jouster in the lists of love, but as an intelligent onlooker, she knew how the game was played. No wonder the book had sold like hotcakes. Half the recipes told you how to make them. It was surprising the pages hadn't singed. And it was by a Lunkra witch. The world was, Granny Weatherwax modestly admitted, well aware of who the witch of Lunkra was, viz. It was her.
"Githa Ogg," she said.
"Yes, Esme?"
"Githa Ogg, you look me in the eye."
"Sorry, Esme."
"A Lunkra witch, it says here."
"I never thought, Esme."
"So you'll go and see Mr. Goatburger and have this stopped, right? I don't want people looking at me and thinking about the banana-nana soup surprise. I don't even believe the banana-nana soup surprise. And I ain't relishing going down the street and hearing people making cracks about bananas."
"Yes, Esme."
"And I'll come with you to make sure you do."
"Yes, Esme."
"And we'll talk to the man about your money. Yes, Esme. And we might just drop in on young Agnes to make sure she's all right.
Yes, Esme.
And we'll do it diplomatic-like. We don't want people thinking we're poking our noses in.
Yes, Esme.
No one could say I interfere when I'm not wanted. You won't find anyone calling me a busybody.
Yes, Esme.
That was, yes, Esme, you won't find anyone calling you a busybody, was it?
Oh, yes, Esme.
You sure about that?
Yes, Esme.
Good.
Granny looked out at the dull grey sky and the dying leaves, and felt, amazingly enough, her sap rising. A day ago, the future had looked aching and desolate, and now it looked full of surprises, and terror, and bad things happening to people. If she had anything to do with it, anyway. In the scullery, Nanny Ogg grinned to herself. Agnes had known a little bit about the theatre. A travelling company came to Lancre sometimes. Their stage was about twice the size of a door, and backstage consisted of a bit of sacking, behind which was usually a man trying to change trousers and wigs at the same time, and another man dressed as a king, having a surreptitious smoke. The opera house was almost as big as the Patrician's Palace, and far more palatial. It covered 3 acres. There was stabling for 20 horses and 2 elephants in the cellar. Agnes spent some time there, because the elephants were reassuringly larger than her. There were rooms behind the stage so big that entire sets were stored there. There was a whole ballet school somewhere in the building. Some of the girls were on stage now, ugly in woolly jumpers, going through a routine. The inside of the opera house, at least the backstage inside, put Agnes strongly in mind of the clock her brother had taken apart to find the tick. It was hardly a building, it was more like a machine. Sets and curtains and ropes hung in the darkness like dreadful things in a forgotten cellar. The stage was only a small part of the place, a little rectangle of light in a huge, complicated darkness full of significant machinery. A piece of dust floated down from the blackness high above. She brushed it off.
"I thought I heard someone up there," she said.
"It's probably the ghost," said Christine. "We've got one, you know. Oh, I said we. Oh, isn't this exciting?"
"A man with his face covered by a white mask," said Agnes.
"You've heard about him, then?"
"What? Who?"
"The ghost."
Blast, thought Agnes. It was always ready to catch her out, just when she thought she'd put all that behind her. She'd know things without quite knowing why. It upset people. It certainly upset her.
"Oh, I suppose someone must have told me," she mumbled.
"He moves around the opera house invisibly, they say. One moment he'll be in the gods, and the next moment he'll be backstage somewhere. No one knows how he does it."
"Really?"
"They say he watches every performance. That's why they never sell tickets for Box 8. Didn't you know?"
"Box 8? Said Agnes. "What's a box?"
"Boxes! You know, that's where you get the best people. Look, I shall show you."
Christine marched to the front of the stage and waved a hand grandly at the empty auditorium.
"The boxes," she said, "over there and right up there. The gods."
Her voice bounced back from the distant wall.
"Aren't the best people in the gods? Sounds..."
"Oh, no. The best people will be in the boxes, or possibly in the stalls."
Agnes pointed.
"Who's down there? They must get a good view."
"Don't be silly. That's the pit. That's for the musicians."
"Well, that makes sense anyway. Which one's Box 8?
"I don't know. But they say if ever they sell seats in Box 8, there'll be a dreadful tragedy. Isn't that romantic?"
For some reason, Agnes's practical eye was drawn to the huge chandelier that hung over the auditorium like a fantastic sea monster. Its thick rope disappeared into the darkness near the ceiling. The glass chimes tinkled. Another flare of that certain power which Agnes did her best to suppress at every turn flashed a treacherous image across her mind.
"That looks like an accident waiting to happen if ever I saw one," she mumbled.
"I'm sure it's perfectly safe," trilled Christine. "I'm sure they wouldn't allow..."
A cord rolled out, shaking the stage. The chandelier tinkled, and more dust came down.
"What was that?" said Agnes.
"It was the organ. It's so big, it's behind the stage. Come on, let's go and see."
Other members of the staff were hurrying towards the organ. There was an overturned bucket nearby, and a spreading pool of green paint. A carpenter reached past Agnes and picked up an envelope that was lying on the organ seat.
"It's for the boss," he said.
"When it's my mail, the postman usually just knocks," said a ballerina, and giggled.
Agnes looked up. Ropes swung lazily in the musty darkness. For a moment she thought she saw a flash of white, and then it was gone. There was a shape, just visible, tangled in the ropes. Something wet and sticky dripped down and splashed on the keyboard. People were already screaming when Agnes reached past, dipped her finger in the growing puddle, and sniffed.
"It's blood," said the carpenter.
"It's blood, isn't it?" said a musician.
"Blood!" screamed Christine. "Blood!"
It was Agnes's terrible fate to keep her head in a crisis. She sniffed her finger again.
"It's turpentine," said Agnes. Sorry, is that wrong?"
Up in the tangle of ropes, the figure moaned.
"Shouldn't we get him down?" she added.
Candu Cutoff was a humble woodcutter. He wasn't humble because he was a woodcutter. He would still have been quite humble if he'd owned 5 logging mills. He was just naturally humble. And he was unpretentiously stacking some logs at the point where the Lancre Road met the main mountain road when he saw a farm cart rumble to a halt and unload 2 elderly ladies in black. Both carried a broomstick in one hand and a sack in the other. They were arguing. It was not a raised-voice argument, but a chronic wrangle that had clearly been going on for some time and was set in for the rest of the decade.
"It's all very well for you, but it's my $3, so I don't see why I can't say how we go."
"I likes flying."
"And I'm telling you, it's too drafty on broomsticks this time of year, Esme. The breeze gets into places I wouldn't dream of talking about."
"Really? Can't imagine where those would be, then."
"Oh, Esme."
"Don't owe Esme me. It weren't me that come up with the amusing wedding trifle with the special sponge fingers."
"Anyway, Grebo don't like it on the broomstick. He's got a delicate stomach."
Cutoff noticed that one of the sacks was moving in a lazy way.
"Gither, I've seen him eat half a skunk, so don't tell me about his delicate stomach," said Granny, who disliked cats on principle. "Anyway, he's been doing it again."
Nanny Ogg waved her hands airily.
"Oh, he only does it sometimes when he's really in a corner," she said.
"He did it in old Mrs. Grope's hen house last week. She went in to see what all the ruckus was, and he did it right in front of her. She had to have a lie down."
"He was probably more frightened than she was," said Nanny defensively.
"That's what comes of getting strange ideas in foreign parts," said Granny. "Now you've got a cat who..." "Yes, what is it?"
Cutoff had meekly approached them and was hovering in the kind of half-crouch of someone trying to be noticed while also not wanting to intrude.
"Are you ladies waiting for the stagecoach?"
"Yes," said the taller of the ladies.
I'm afraid the next coach doesn't stop here. It doesn't stop until Creel Springs."
They gave him a couple of polite stares.
"Thank you,"
said the tall one. She turned to her companion.
"It gave her a nasty shock, anyway. I dread to think what he'll learn this time."
"He pines when I'm gone. He won't take food from anyone else.
Only 'cause they try to poison him. And no wonder."
Cutoff shook his head sadly and wandered back to his log pile. The coach turned up 5 minutes later, coming around the corner at speed. It drew level with the women and stopped. That is, the horses tried to stand still and the wheels locked. It wasn't so much a skid as a spin, and the whole thing gradually came to rest about 50 yards down the road, with the driver in a tree. The women strolled towards it, still arguing. One of them poked the driver with her broomstick.
2 tickets to Unkmorpork, please."
He landed in the road.
"Well, what do you mean, 2 tickets to Unkmorpork? The coach doesn't stop here."
"Looks stopped to me."
"Did you do something?"
"What, us?"
"Listen, lady, even if I was stopping here, the tickets are $40 damn each."
"Oh."
"Why have you got broomsticks?" shouted the driver. "Are you witches?"
"Yes. Have you got any special low terms for witches?"
"Yeah. How about meddling, interfering old baggages?"
Cutoff felt that he must have missed part of the conversation, because the next exchange went like this.
"What was that again, young man?"
"2 complimentary tickets to Unkmorpork, ma'am. No problem."
"Inside seats, mind. No travelling on the top."
"Certainly, ma'am. Excuse me while I just kneel in the dirt so you can step up, ma'am."
Cutoff nodded happily to himself as the coach pulled away again. It was nice to see that good manners and courtesy were still alive. With great difficulty and much shouting and untangling of ropes far above, the figure was lowered to the stage. He was soaked in paint and turpentine. The swelling audience of off-duty staff and rehearsal truants crowded in around him. Agnes knelt down, loosened his collar, and tried to unwind the rope that had caught around arm and neck.
"Does anyone know him?" she said.
"It's Tommy Cripps," said a musician. "He paints scenery."
Tommy moaned and opened his eyes.
I saw him,"
he muttered.
"It was horrible."
"Saw what?" said Agnes, and then she had a sudden feeling that she'd intruded on some private conversation. Around her there was a babble of voices.
"Giselle said she saw him last week."
"He's here."
"It's happening again."
"Are we all doomed?"
squeaked Christine. Tommy Cripps gripped Agnes's arm.
"He's got a face like death."
"Who?"
"The ghost."
"What ghost?"
"It's white bone. He has no nose."
A couple of ballet dancers fainted, but carefully so as not to get their clothes dirty.
"Then how does he..." Agnes began.
"I saw him too."
On cue, the company turned. An elderly man advanced across the stage. He wore an ancient opera hat and carried a sack over one shoulder, while his spare hand made the needlessly expansive gestures of someone who has got hold of some direful information and can't wait to freeze all nearby spines. The sack must have contained something alive because it was bouncing around.
"I saw him. Oh, yes. With his great black cloak and his white face with no eyes, but only two holes where eyes should be. Ooh! And..."
"He had a mask on," said Agnes.
The old man paused and shot her the dark look reserved for all those who insist on injecting a note of sanity when things are getting interestingly ghastly.
"And he had no nose," he went on, ignoring her.
"I just said that,"
muttered Tommy Cripps in a rather annoyed voice.
"I told them that. They already know that."
"If he had no nose, how did he smell?"
Agnes began, but no one was listening to her.
"Did you mention about the eyes?"
said the old man.
"I was just getting round to the eyes,"
snapped Tommy.
"Yes, he had eyes like..."
"Are we talking about some kind of mask here?"
said Agnes. Now everyone was giving her that kind of look UFOologists get when they suddenly say, "Hey, if you shade your eyes, you can see it is just a flock of geese, after all." The man with the sack coughed and regrouped.
"Like great holes they were,"
he began, but it was clear that it had all been spoiled for him.
"Great holes," he said sourly. "That's what I saw. And no nose, I might add. Thank you so very much."
"It's the ghost again,"
said a scene shifter.
"He jumped out from behind the organ,"
said Tommy Cripps.
"Next thing I knew, there was a rope around me neck, and I was upside down."
The company looked at the man with the sack, in case he could trump this.
"Great black holes,"
he managed, sticking to what he knew.
"All right, everyone, what's going on here?"
An imposing figure strode out of the wings. He had flowing black hair, carefully brushed to give it a carefree, al fresco look, but the face underneath was the face of an organizer. He nodded at the old man with the sack.
"What are you staring at, Mr. Pounder?"
he said. The old man looked down.
"I knows what I saw, Mr. Salzeller," he said. "I see lots of things, I do."
"As much as is visible through the bottom of a bottle, I have no doubt, you old reprobate. What happened to Tommy?"
"It was the ghost,"
said Tommy, delighted to have centre stage again.
"He swooped out at me, Mr. Salzeller. I think my leg is broken,"
he added quickly, in the voice of one who is suddenly aware of the time-off opportunities of the situation. Agnes expected the newcomer to say something like, "Ghosts, there's no such thing." He had the kind of face that said that. Instead, he said,
"Back again, is he? Where did he go?"
"Didn't see, Mr. Salzeller. He just swooped off again."
"Some of you help Tommy down to the canteen," said Salzeller, "and someone else fetch a doctor."
"His leg isn't broken," said Agnes, "but that's a nasty rope burn on his neck, and he's filled his own ear with paint."
"What do you know about it, miss?"
said Tommy. A paint-filled ear didn't sound as though it had the possibilities of a broken leg.
I've had some training," said Agnes, and then added quickly, "It's a nasty burn, though, and of course there may be some delayed shock."
"Oh, brandy is very good for that, isn't it?"
said Tommy.
"Perhaps you could try forcing some between my lips."
"Thank you, Perdita. The rest of you go back to what you were doing," said Salzella.
"Big dark holes," said Mr. Pounder. "Big ones."
"Yes, thank you, Mr. Pounder. Help Ron with Mr. Cripps, will you? Perdita, you come here. And you, Christine?"
The two girls stood before the director of music.
"Did you see anything?" said Salzella.
"I saw a great creature with great flapping wings and great big holes where his eyes should be," said Christine.
"I'm afraid I just saw something white up in the ceiling," said Agnes. "Sorry." She blushed, aware of how useless that sounded. Perdita would have seen a mysterious, cloaked figure or something. Something interesting. Salzella smiled at her.
"You mean you just see things that are really there?" he said. "I can see you haven't been with the opera for long, dear, but I may say I'm pleased to have a level-headed person around here for once."
"Oh, no!" screamed someone.
"It's the ghost!"
shrieked Christine automatically.
It's the young man behind the organ," said Agnes. "Sorry."
"Observant as well as level-headed," said Salzella, "whereas I can see that you, Christine, will fit right in here. What's the matter, André?"
A fair-haired young man peered around the organ pipes.
"Someone's been smashing things, Mr. Salzella," he said mournfully. "The pallet springs, and the back falls, and everything. Completely ruined. I'm sure I won't be able to get a tune out of it. And it's priceless."
Salzella sighed.
"All right, I'll tell Mr. Bucket," he said. "Thank you, everyone."
He gave Agnes a gloomy nod and strode off.
"You shouldn't ought to do that to people," said Nanny Ogg in a vague sort of way, as the coach began to get up speed.
She looked around with a wide, friendly grin at the now rather dishevelled occupants of the coach.
"Morning," she said, delving into the sack. "I'm Githa Ogg. I've got 15 children. This is my friend Esme Weatherwax. We're going to Ankh-Morpork. Would anyone like an egg sandwich? I've brung plenty. The cat's been sleeping on them, but they're fine. Look, they bend back all right. No? Please yourself, I'm sure. Let's see what else we've got. Ah, has anybody got an opener for a bottle of beer?"
A man in the corner indicated that he might have such a thing.
"Fine," said Nanny Ogg. "Anyone got something to drink a bottle of beer out of?"
Another man nodded hopefully.
"Good," said Nanny Ogg. "Now, has anybody got a bottle of beer?"
Granny, for once not the centre of attention, as all horrified eyes were on Nanny and her sack, surveyed the other occupants of the coach. The express stage went right over the ramtops and all the way through the patchwork of little countries beyond. If it cost $40 just from Lankra, then it must have cost these people a lot more. What sort of folk spent the best part of 2 months' wages just to travel fast and uncomfortably? The thin man who sat clutching his bag was probably a spy, she decided. The fat man who'd volunteered the glass looked as if he sold things. He had the unpleasant complexion of someone who'd hit too many bottles but missed too many meals. They were huddled together on their seat because the rest of it was occupied by a man of almost wizardly proportions. He didn't appear to have woken up when the coach stopped. There was a handkerchief over his face. He was snoring with the regularity of a geezer and looked as though the only worries he might have in the world were a tendency for small objects to gravitate towards him and the occasional tide. Nanny Ogg continued to rummage round in her bag, and as was the case when she was preoccupied, her mouth had wired itself to her eyeballs without her brain intervening. She was used to travelling by broomstick. Long-distance ground travel was a novelty to her, so she prepared with some care.
Let's see now. Book of puzzles for long journeys. Cushion. Foot powder. Mosquito trap. Phrase book. Bag to be sick in too. Oh dear.
The audience, which against all probability had managed to squeeze itself further away from Nanny during the litany, waited with horrified interest.
What? Said Granny. How often do you reckon this coach stops?
What's the matter?
I should have gone before we left. Sorry, it's the jolting. Anyone know if there's a privy on this thing?
She added brightly. Said the probable spy, we generally wait until the next stop, or... He stopped. He had been about to add, there's always the window, which was a manly option on the bumpier rural stretches, but he stopped himself in the horrible apprehension that this ghastly old woman might seriously consider the possibility.
There's O'Hoolan just a bit further on the road, said Granny, who was trying to doze. You just wait.
This coach doesn't stop at O'Hoolan, said the spy helpfully.
Granny Weatherwax raised her head.
Up until now, that is, said the spy.
Mr. Bucket was sitting in his office trying to make sense of the Opera House's books. They didn't make any kind of sense. He reckoned he was as good as the next man at reading a balance sheet, but these were to bookkeeping what grit was to clockwork. Selden Bucket had always enjoyed opera. He didn't understand it, and never had, but he didn't understand the ocean either, and he enjoyed that too. He looked upon the purchase as, well, something to do, a sort of working retirement. The offer had been too good to pass up. Things had been getting pretty tough in the wholesale cheese and milk derivatives business, and he'd been looking forward to the quieter climes of the world of art. The previous owners had put on some good operas. It was only a shame that their genius hadn't run to bookkeeping as well. Money seemed to have been taken out of the accounts when anyone needed it. The financial record system largely consisted of notes on torn bits of paper saying, "I've taken $30 to pay Q, see you Monday, R." Who was R? Who was Q? What was the money for? You wouldn't get away with this sort of thing in the world of cheese. He looked up as the door opened. "Ah, Sal Zeller," he said. "Thank you for coming. You don't know who Q is, by any chance?"
"No, Mr. Bucket."
"Or R?"
"I'm afraid not."
Sal Zeller pulled up a chair. "It's taken me all morning, but I worked out we pay more than $1,500 a year for ballet shoes," said Bucket, waving a piece of paper in the air. Sal Zeller nodded. "Yes, they do rather go through them at the toes. I mean, it's ridiculous. I've still got a pair of boots belonging to my father." "But ballet shoes, sir, are rather more like foot gloves," Sal Zeller explained.
"You're telling me. They cost $7 a pair, and they last hardly any time at all. A few performances. There must be some way we can make a saving."
Sal Zeller gave his new employer a long, cool stare.
"Possibly we could ask the girls to spend more time in the air," he said. "A few extra grand jetés."
Bucket looked puzzled.
Would that work?" he said suspiciously. "Well, their feet wouldn't be on the ground for so long, would they?"
said Sal Zeller, in the tones of one who knows for a fact that he's much more intelligent than anyone else in the room.
"Oh, good point, good point. Have a word with the ballet mistress, will you?" "Of course. I am sure she will welcome the suggestion. You may well have halved costs at a stroke."
Bucket beamed.
"Which is perhaps just as well," said Sal Zeller. "There is, in fact, another matter that I've come to see you about."
"Yes?"
"It is to do with the organ we had."
"Had? What do you mean, had?" said Bucket, adding, "You're going to tell me something expensive, are you? What have we got now?"
"A lot of pipes and some keyboards," said Sal Zeller. "Everything else has been smashed."
"Smashed? By who?" Sal Zeller leaned back. He was not a man to whom amusement came easily, but he realized that he was rather enjoying this.
"Tell me," he said, "when Mr. Pnigeus and Mr. Cavea sold you this opera house, did they mention anything supernatural?"
Bucket scratched his head.
Well, yes. After I'd signed and paid,
it was a bit of a joke.
They said, and by the way, people say there's some man in evening dress who haunts the place. Ha, ha, ha. Ridiculous, isn't it? These theatrical people, like children, really. Ha, ha, ha. But you may find it keeps them happy if you always keep Box 8 free on first nights. Ha, ha, ha.
I remember that quite well. Handing over $30,000 concentrates the memory a bit. And then they rode off. Quite a fast carriage, now I come to think about it."
"Ah," said Sal Zeller, and he almost smiled. "Well, now that the ink is dry, I wonder if I might fill you in on the fine detail."